Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Reading the poetry of Martine Bellin is an excursion into a fascinating labyrinth of language that evokes multiple meanings. Her work is more to be experienced with the heart and soul than dissected with the mind. Her latest poetry collection is The Wayback Machine. The title references both the Rocky and Bullwinkle show, as well as the past iterations of the internet. Fellow poet Charles North wrote, "Martine Bellin's psychological and linguistic adventures in poetry are unlike anyone else's. Celebrating the instabilities of our experience, her poems maneuver kaleidoscopically between ordinary life and myth or fairy tale, vital human concerns such as identity, and dreamlike atmospheres where nothing stays as it appears for long." Martine Bellin is the author of 8 collections of poetry, including Tales of Murasaki and Other Poems, which won the National Poetry Series Award, as well as a novella, Two Times Squared, and several librettos for opera. Bellin is a contributing editor of the literary journal Conjunctions. Martine Bellin, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much. I'm very happy to be here.
Now, your poetry volume, is it pronounced Wayback Machine?
Yes, Wayback Machine. It comes from Mr. Peabody's improbable history from the Rocky and Bullwinkle show. And Mr. Peabody would take Sherman into the Wayback Machine, the time machine. And time and space are two of the aspects that I explore in the collection.
Those are themes that run through, and also memory.
Yes, memory also, and identity, and how one defines oneself, and the numerous identities that lives in each of us. The first poem, Customers Who Have Bought Sleeping Beauty Have Also Bought This, starts with a dictionary. And then one of the last poems, Metropolis, ends with a dictionary.
And actually, I'd like to get right to it and ask you to read this first page of Customers Who Have Bought Sleeping Beauty Have Also Bought This.
So often the pieces are longer than one might expect for poetry. I'll read the first page. So it starts with a dictionary, a definition of me, capital M-E, and it's a pronoun and the objective case of I, and then there are 5 definitions. 1, a state in New England. 2, me, a concept in the cosmology of Sumerian mythology. 3, net energy available in certain foods. 4, a think group that resides in my head. A large furry animal, a me, the me. And 5, a bullet's point of entry. Upon awakening from a story, before walking through the portal to the hallway into a land where language is required, I confirm I'm me, parentheses, a state in New England, and parentheses, a think group, and parentheses. Some days I don't arrive at the threshold of my body, and a deep, cavernous loss resides where me would have been. The cave paintings in Lascaux, horses, bulls, and stags, motifs that repeat when I can't see where I'm headed, when I'm in a forest. Some days I ingest donuts and sourdough. Some days I sleep deep in mud, like a fish that wants to stop drifting, day into night into day.
I love this. And I'm going to ask you first to just explain some of the definitions, because I've never heard of them before. And I'm not going to so much ask you to explain the poem per se, but just these, me, a concept in the cosmology of Sumerian mythology?
Well, in this poem or story, I'm working with fairy tales. A number of pieces in the book, I use fairy tales or fairy tale motifs because of their cross-cultural expansion. And I also, you know, have referred to Jung in some of the poems, and the idea of the archetype is important to me. So mythology and how different cultures throughout time and expanse connect to one another. So what I'm working with too also is the idea of the truth, and the truth as we know it in volumes such as the dictionary, which is, of course, a fluctuating, always changing truth. So I'm playing with that a little bit, and also the sense of the me and the identity of who I am. So these most of these aren't really me. I mean, me is I, which we all, and also me is a state in New England. But other than that, there is no me is not those things. But it's interesting, you know, when you think about that, like, for instance, something that I was working with in this particular poem is I'm interested in Chinese and Japanese culture and language. And so one of the things that interests me, I was studying Shodo Japanese calligraphy, and it interests me how a specific word has very different meanings in different contexts. In English, this is less so. I mean, probably it is a little bit in ways that I'm not necessarily conscious. But I know in Japanese and Chinese, the use of a word, for instance, koi, fish, is a fish. And it also means something like, come here, you know. So words, you'll have, let's say, the word for sky, or I think it's emptiness, and sky are the same word that you'll see, let's say, in a parking lot that's empty. And so having to define the word through the context becomes very important. And so that's something else that I'm playing around with in this particular poem. And in the poem, The Memory Group, as you had mentioned, memory is something that is also very interesting to me, something I think a lot about as my memory gets worse and worse, especially. And my grandmother had Alzheimer's. So it's a fear and something that I'm very, very conscious about. And, you know, also, as you know, as I see people and generations pass away and die, the draining of memory is something I find very important, you know, something that I'm very aware of. And so in this particular poem, I have this one line, the ability to choose the correct meaning of an action appropriate to a particular social situation. And that is important in terms of the soundness of one's mind, but also in terms of just living with a language where meanings are so various that that's just a, you know, a regular occurrence. So those are some of the ideas that I was playing with in terms of having the dictionary and having false or untrue, perhaps untrue, definitions of me, because maybe I am the net energy of certain foods. You know, I mean, I am energy. I am that too. And I am a large furry animal also. So these aren't not me. I am also a think group. I'm a very, very big think group that resides in my head. So it's not like I'm not these things. I am these things, but they probably aren't the definition that one would see in a dictionary.
And a bullet's point of entry.
Yeah, I mean, I was just thinking about the way that we penetrate life and also the violence in our lives. And so that definition is so different than the other definitions. And I was looking for something that was so different because, again, you know, thinking about languages where the definitions vary so much, I was looking for a definition that really, you know, had a certain amount of violence and a certain amount of penetration in it. So, yeah.
And also it seems that a poem was almost a bullet's point of entry.
Yeah, that's true. I hadn't thought of that, but it's true. I mean, the poem itself is that. It's trying to enter. I mean, my work is what I would call experiential. I think that when a reader is reading it or listening to it, rather than mastering it and understanding, you know, feeling as though, okay, I can write, let's say, a thesis on this, that hopefully the poem will find its way into the reader and there'll be this relationship of embodiment. But I do want to connect to people with my work. I want that to be the connection. So that would be, I guess, the bullet entering into the listener or the reader. And so, yeah.
In these poems, they had, in a way, the nature of what I imagine a Zen koan is, in the sense that they're meant to disrupt the hyper left brain intellectual processes. Am I right about that?
Yes, definitely. Or at least I feel as though some of the questions that arise through Zen, and when I say through Zen, I mean not only on the cushion, but then off of the cushion in life, are questions that I'm exploring in this work. There's the one poem, Snowing Oven. I felt as though that poem came out of a little bit of a different impulse for me that felt very much like Cohen work, and which was really fun.
And first, tell our listeners, what is a Cohen?
Well, a Cohen is, it's a story word puzzle in mostly in a Renzai practice, but also sometimes in Soto, you'll have it where the sitter will sit with this koan. And a very well-known koan is what is the sound of one hand clapping. It's really the koan is just with one hand, not with the clapping, but in this country we tend to say clapping. And so then you sit with this question or these words that are impossible to answer, and you can't answer them with your logical mind. It's the opposite of your analytical mind. For many Americans, that's difficult because many of us think of our mind as our brain, and so to start thinking about the mind as something else, to think about the mind in connection with the body and the heart and the being is I think a little bit of a challenge for some people. For me, definitely, you know, the idea of getting away from the brain and figuring things out. And that's a big part of what the koan is, to break free from figuring it out. But at the same time, that all the answers are there, that we, you know, that each of us have all the answers. And that's also an interesting idea for a society, for a world that emphasizes going outside of the self for teachings, to say, okay, well, we all have what we need. We all have the teachings inside of ourselves if we sit with them and look for them and be with them. So that's Cohen. So I'll read this then. So the poem's title is Snowing Oven. And I wrote this poem, a poet, Joanna Furman, who is an editor for a journal in Big Sur called Ping Pong, asked a group of people if they would be interested in writing poems that are based on a poem called What Is That? By the sculptor artist Jean Arp. And so this poem, What Is That? Is a series of questions. So I read, you know, the poem, and there were these two lines of the poem that really resonated with me. There is nothing but snow in that white hot stove. And so I worked with that almost as a koan, it felt like, when I was working with it. And so this is what came up. When you open your smiling oven, steaming noodles and goodies, some snow leopards sleep on the mount of my tongue. So adept in hiding are they that I barely know when they're there, though sometimes a purr melting through me, preheat. Open wide. There is nothing in your mouth, just a wintry mix, groomed trails, slopes, more snow squalls, more drifts. I get it. You wouldn't say what was in the oven, your mouth closed for the weather, for winter. Snow spices, pickens. After all, melting is not the same as disappearing. Your open smile, heat. If I drill through your snow to the hidden lake region, baking ancient snow, swirling frosting, icing. It's snowing, nothing to do but bake, always so tempting to open a warm, fresh smile.
Yes, and I see it exactly what you mean. It's like I thoroughly enjoy that. I can't explain it in any, you know, like this means this or this means that, but I feel like I know it.
Right. Yeah, that is what I'm, you know, what I'm hoping for, is for someone to feel comfortable with my work. Also, I use a lot of humor. I mean, I do address questions that I think of as very important, so that there is a certain gravitas in some of the work. But at the same time, I like there to be humor. And I also like for the language to lead to the next word, so that I feel as though I'm in a relationship with the language that I'm writing, and I'm not always guiding it. I'm actually it's usually guiding me, and it's showing me the next step of where to go. And that often starts with the sounds of the words.
And a book that is titled in reference to something in Rocky and Bullwinkle can't be completely serious.
Exactly, right. And also, I mean, some of the work in the third section of the book, I have some work that addresses anime and manga. And so I work with cartoons also. I'm interested in cartoons because, you know, one of the themes in the book has to do with reality and, you know, and questioning what is reality. And I find that, anime and cartoons allow for reality to bend in on itself and expand out from itself. And, you know, so in cartoons, of course, you know, somebody will jump from, you know, be pushed off a rock and they'll get smashed and then they'll walk off. And so there's this other whole reality. In fact, even in anime, you'll have a lot of characters will have, you know, purple hair and round eyes. And so, you know, even though it's Japanese, the race is its own race. It's the anime race. And so I think it's interesting how we all understand this other kind of reality and accept it.
And we're talking with Martine Bellin about her new poetry volume. It's called Wayback Machine. I wondered if you could also read, this is another part of the first poem that you spoke about. Customers who have bought Sleeping Beauty have also bought this. It's very short, just a paragraph. And I think it encompasses that thinking about deep subjects in a way that enchants and delights.
Thank you for saying that. Okay, so this is part of the same poem, which is customers who have bought Sleeping Beauty have also bought this. And that, of course, refers back to the Amazon. In Amazon, when you buy something, it always gives you suggestions to buy something else, depending on the type of person that you seem to be from what you've bought before. So, she rushes through an hour like a hallway. The alarm rings as she attempts to outrun the wolf, the wind, music imprisoned by its bars, the breath of bars and their throbbing beer-soaked walls. Flesh and time swap outfits. Either way, a jailer enforces a life sentence. Either way, we wither.
And so, do you remember the impetus for this poem?
This poem, I was working mostly with various fairy tale motifs and the idea of death. That's something that always... I mean, that's just one of the questions that I think everybody has, right? I mean, and death is so much a part of fairy tales and cartoons.
And kind of the question, will I still be me when I die?
Right, exactly. So in this particular section, again, I'm playing a lot with words and how close they are to one another. So when you look at even a character like the wolf in a fairy tale, what happens if the wolf was the wind? You know, what happens when you just kind of change the composition of one character to another character, an animate to an inanimate to an animate? And where does that leave us? And then also, of course, looking at the idea of the sentence that we read, because this is a though it's, I think of it as a poem, it's a prose poem. And a lot of my work is in the, not all of it, but much, I use the sentence a lot. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, the life sentence.
And talking about fairy tales, I mean, there's the Hansel and Gretel poem. There are a number of them. I love this one, too, if you wouldn't mind just reading that, which is part of the poem called The Gossamer Tincture.
Yeah, I use Hansel and Gretel a lot in this poem, and I also, I'm working a lot with the idea of losing things. In this poem, the main character loses objects, she loses identity, she is a bride, she's like loses being a bride. But the one thing that she seems to keep throughout is her twin brother, And twins, that's always something that's interested me. I guess that idea of the other, the doppelganger, you know, the deep connection that maybe we have with each other, but some special connection also. So this is a section from this piece. She used to be the sister and wandered directionless in the broad forest with her lost brother. If she hadn't lost her wits, she'd be witch fodder like that twin. I dedicated this poem to the poet Melinda Markham. I actually, Melinda Markham committed suicide, and she is an amazing poet. She wrote two books, 95 Nights of Listening and Having Cut the Sparrow's Heart. And she's an incredible poet. She was younger, I don't know how much younger, but I know she was younger than I am. And she recently committed suicide. And I started writing this poem before that happened. But I felt like after I finished the poem, there was so much in it that kind of reminded me of her. Her poems have a lot of fairy tale work in it. And both she and I have issues of getting lost. I can get lost anywhere. I'm always so pleased with myself when I don't get lost. And I always find getting anywhere an adventure. And I think she had even more problem with getting lost than I do. But so I started looking at the poem and it had so many parts of it reminded me of her. And so I wanted to offer it to her.
Do you want to read another part?
Yeah, I'll read. I like this part. Okay. So again, in the story, this is very much more of a narrative than some of my pieces, where you really do have this one young bride. I think she's mostly identified as a bride, and her world seems to be falling apart, falling away from her. So here she says, she knew her husband lived a secret, ponderous, separate life from his meanderings in the small thatched cottage they shared together. In a dream, she combed through his pockets and found a map of his daily travels. There on the east side of the map, near where the sun rose, was their life together, while up above into the west were multitudinous kingdoms rich with tapestries of eels and unicorns, firstborns, mint gardens, mine gardens, and fair maidens haunting deep wells, showered as she was with small trinkets and favors and magical words. Jealousy is yellow, drinking calms it. She poured herself into the glass. Many cracks defaced her vista. There was the earth with its small fissures, the sky with light chips cracking through, and the mirror that exaggerated the cracks around her eyes. There was the fractured ocean crashing and cracking at the seams with tornadoes of light, and also a heaviness she could not name.
It's so visual. I could just picture the whole thing as you were reading.
Yeah, I do work with a lot of imagery, and you know, and again, I counter that also with the sounds of the words, and I kind of explore that the connection between sound and picture. Yeah,
could you say a little more about that?
Well, okay. For instance, there's a poem that "The Secret Conversing of Birds." I'm working with the 13th century Persian poet Rumi and also Farid ud-Din Attar, the 12th century poet who wrote The Conference of the Birds. But mostly what I'm working with is the way that movement and sound and poetry can dance together. And so the images are hopefully very vivid. But at the same time, the sound itself is constantly dancing and circling. And so I'm thinking about whirling dervishes and what home means. And so home, which is, a very interesting sounding word in that it's so open, home. It's really almost like a breath. It's almost like om. So that's very much the foundation and center of this work. And at the same time, the images, many of them bird images, are holding on to that sound basically so that it's not just sound, but there's the dancing images. So I can read that if, yeah, okay. So the secret conversing of birds. Sometimes it starts with a murder of crows congregating on an echoing field of Persian onions in bloom. wild leeks, crimson poppy. Caw, caw. The crow circles its cry, never returning to the taking place, the spin-off point, as if Dr. Maximus of theosophical speculation, donned in body's negative dervish frock, swims the earth's solid breath. Coo, coo, where, where? Is he listening to melodic hammering at the goldsmith's smithy, dancing for hours, never turning twice, as if the good doctor were exiled in the flesh of Rumi, where illuminations join at the interior and anterior edge, where everything is the same, only somehow something is not. His feminine tears submerge the bolted landscape as they mutually dissolve. With loss of motion goes memory. With collapsed space, our dervish halts, uttering, utterly, alone, uttering to strings of light. Coo, coo, he says. Coo, coo, they reply, into the shelter of thought that forms a hapless desire for a deep, divine homelessness, as if homelessing amounts to attaining or being initiated into the inspirited inspirialis, as if buildings abruptly refuse to conceal their exhausting dance, as we follow our homes into our lives, as if our lives depend on our seeking or seeing, scrying tears where poeming commences, as if the ancient dances of homing and whirling were distinct, as we circle our cries to call ourselves home.
And Martine Bellin continues reading her poem, The Secret Conversing of Birds, online, because, alas, we have run out of time for today's show. There's also much more to our conversation at writersvoice.net. Visit the website to hear the rest. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with poet Martine Bellin about her most recent published book of poetry, Wayback Machine. And talking about a Wayback Machine, you mentioned before that time is also a common theme running through your work. And there is a poem called Time Machine. Now, it's a bit long, but I wonder if you could read at least part of this, maybe just begin.
A time machine. Way back is mentioned in Time Machine, and that was the really actually the one reference to way back in the collection. And this poem works with Ouspensky's idea of the house as the house is a structure that that bodies walk through. And I was thinking about that. I was thinking about the connection.
And who is Ouspensky?
He was a student of Gurdjieff, the mystic in the early 20th century. And so this was one of his ideas about the house, and I was working with that idea. So I dedicated this poem to him, and thinking about the way that people walk through houses, and if you think of the house as our body, and we as let's say the soul or the mind or the being walking through the house. Leaving the house as though we were leaving our bodies. And so I work with that idea, which is the Ouspensky's idea, in this poem, Time Machine. So I'll read it. She understood the threats came from infinity, the warnings from someone who watched her all the time, subliminally tried to persuade her to escape her own house, to jump from the top window of her mind. Particularly vocal were old structures. Victorians and carpenter Gothics were loudest, the pinks more insistent than white ones. People who lived within them were their thoughts, feelings, moods that wandered aimlessly through houses, like the role that the eye of our personalities play. They sometimes live in us for a long time, so long we might think they are us. They usually come and go, a mood watching another mood being played by a different mood. Sometimes one will walk out the front door and never return. A mood watcher marched into a deserted field. She felt deserted, couldn't see her body field was densely populated. Exactly why time abridges while space does not, she can't say. Space her cloak, time her clock, storied in the memory room with a window to be peered into. Mind tricks? Self-delusion fades subject from his fellows, is a time machine, splits locations, fragmented bullets on a battlefield, body field. The fear that she is trapped in a glass bottle, a ghost bottle, or if a screen isn't used with her, blue bottle flies will colonize her dreams, or vandals will throw stones through her fenestrated words, and she'll cry viscous tears, or that she'll die and vanish. Her errands take her from one end of Main Street to the other. She dreads passing houses on her return, their pining pleas, litanies of disappointments, blameful belligerence, hearing them wail. Another mood slams the door on the way in, slams into her face. She peeks into the time hole window, heat from the fall sun warning her, warming her, falling. No moods or minds. A Chinese poet alone with an empty bottle of spirits on a battlefield memory of fractured men. Circulating light loops and blows through time, which isn't a machine without a mad scientist to build and drive it, as though madness isn't constructed from riveted time warps. It is equally possible that every universe is a way back, losing us in the time of our life, or we're traveling into different bodies over various lives, or time traps travel and we stagger futures, pastures, presence in impermanent form, everlasting flowers.
I just love this. There's so many points of recognition in it. I would assume that any reader is going to find their own points of connection to a poem based on their own experience. So, of course, it's purposeless for me to say which ones they were for me, but there really is a universal experience here that I think you've captured in this poem.
Thank you. You know, and I did try and work with also other images throughout the book. When I'm putting together a book, I pay attention to how the book, let's say, would even read from beginning to end, even though the poems are individual and, you know, and they've all, you know, pretty much appeared individually in different literary journals, whatever. But then when it becomes a book, I think of it as that. And so, for instance, I do have the fragmented bullets on the battlefield body field. And so that, you know, that does harken back to the first point of who am I? Who is me? That is me. And so the idea of the fight and the battlefield as also our body field, and that struggle that we have with our own body, is something that I was working with here.
And also the mood, what is this? A mood watching an other mood being played by a different mood. I mean, that's very much kind of the experience of mindfulness meditation.
Right. Yes. Yes. I mean, I feel like, you know, definitely my work with meditation is in this poem and is in all the poems and questions that I ask myself, and that I'm asked of myself by others. You know, for instance, my teacher, you know, just, working with Zen koans and precepts and those questions, I find that when I'm working on poetry, that although I'm not doing the meditation work, it can't help but come out, because I think partly one of the aspects of meditation work, especially, for instance, koan work, but all of it, is that there's this wordlessness, that there's this languagelessness that we're moving, you know, that we're inhabiting, that you can't say. Anytime you say something, you're not quite there.
Could you explain that a little more?
Yeah, I mean that, you know, for instance, when you're working with koan, sometimes a teacher won't ask you to, let's say, give the answer in language, because language is limiting. It limits to the words that you're saying. And so in that sense, if you think of dualistic thinking, there's so much that is not there in the language that needs to be said also, and that's not being said. So often, you know, you'll always, in Zen stories, you'll have a master that's whacking somebody, or creating an exchange, and that it's within the experience or the exchange that one gets it, not in the words. And of course, historically, Zen and poetry have been very much connected, and so, you know, poetry really, is thought of as part of that experience. But nevertheless, when I am writing and when I'm working with poetry, language is my material in the way, let's say, that paint is a painter's material. But what I'm aiming for may be very similar to a painter who has a canvas, and that's the painter's limit. And my work is with language. I'm aiming for something that resonates outside of language. And somehow I almost think, you know, how artists often will talk about which is the highest art. And I don't really care very much about that discussion. And I don't need to make poetry higher or lower than another art. But I mean, one of the things that's nice about poetry, and I think also music, is that you do have, since it's sound, I mean, it's not only sound based, it's also visual. It's visual based. And so, I mean, when I'm writing, I think about very much what a piece looks like, what letters look like, and how the piece works on the page, and where there are empty spots, and how the lines break, or if they're sentences. But at the same time, it also is musical. And so when you have music, you have reverberation, and you have sound passing beyond that particular second, that particular moment it's being said. So anyway, that the idea of making the poem, but also, you know, hoping, allowing that the experience will be bigger than the words, is similar to Zen practice for me.
Yeah, so you have a poem by Dogen Zenji.
Right.
I wonder if you could read that.
Yeah. There are mountains hidden in treasures. There are mountains hidden in swamps. There are mountains hidden in sky. There are mountains hidden in mountains. There are mountains hidden in hiddenness.
Yeah, I think that expresses, I think, something of what you're saying. It's evocative, but it's not something that is... it's not something that you can explain in words, but it's explaining it in words.
Right, exactly. That's exactly. I mean, Dogen Zenji is a master, and he wrote the treasury of the True Dharma Eye, and about practice and enlightenment. And his work is his poetry. There's such poetry in his writing, and he does offer so many teachings that cannot be, analyzed. It's true poetry, and I think about when I'm reading something that I consider true poetry, I think of him as a true poet, where he's not, where he doesn't restrict himself to what makes sense, or to expressing himself. He doesn't express himself, but something else happens that's really magical.
So were you a poet before you became a Zen practitioner, or was it the other way around?
No, I was a poet before. Well, my first book was published in, I think, 1990. So I've been writing for a long time, and a lot of the themes were present in, you know, the first book is called Places People Dare Not Enter, and on the cover of the book I had a sonogram, and so that was a place that many people left and haven't returned, don't really try to re-enter it. But the themes have been the same. You know, it took me a while to find Zen practice, but I think that was just waiting for me. It was there in my work really all the time, the questions and also some of these ideas about what poetry is and how to find the poem.
Well, Martine Belin, this is a wonderful book of poetry, Wayback Machine, and I want to thank you so much for talking with us here.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.